Back now with Day to Day, and a listener caution here, this next segment does contain language some people are going to find offensive.
Alan Ball is the creator of the critically acclaimed TV series 6 Feet Under. He also wrote the screenplay for the movie American Beauty. He has another TV show and another movie out now. The TV show is about vampires. It's called True Blood, and it debuts this Sunday on HBO. And the movie is called Towelhead. It opens next week. Alan Ball is here with me in our Culver City studios. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Okay, let's talk first about Towelhead.
Okay.
This is about a 13-year-old girl named Jazeera, who is of Middle Eastern descent, and she goes to live with her strict Lebanese father in Houston.
During the first Gulf War.
During the first Gulf War. What do you say when people ask you, what is this movie about?
You know, I believe it's a real story of empowerment. Between being on the receiving end of racism and being on the receiving end of totally inappropriate attention by an older man, Jazeera, sort of just through the sheer power of her own strength and her own spirit, she comes out on the other side of this experience, really being in control of her body and her destiny for the first time. And as I've survived traumatic experience of my own, I thought that was a really, really powerful message.
What do you mean by that?
Well, when I was 13 years old, my sister was killed in a car accident in front of my eyes, and that certainly changed my life. What happens to Jazeera with Mr. Voso certainly resonates with me personally. I don't want to get into the details, but it's one of the reasons that that's a thematic area in my work. And I do believe that for such a common experience, I don't think it always results in a life of being a victim.
Mm-hmm. There's a scene in the movie where she meets her neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to play a little clip.
Your father let you wear makeup? How old are you?
13.
Wow. You look older.
I think what I found interesting about your movie and your portrayal of Jazeera and this older neighbor is that she really doesn't understand how she feels about him. She is attracted to him and scared and repulsed and drawn, and it's very complicated. And he as well, he's not just pure evil.
Oh, no, not at all. You know, Jazeera is trapped in a very sterile life. Both her parents are raging narcissists. She is belittled by the students at school because of her ethnicity. She really has no power or no pleasure in her life. And so the attention that he gives her makes her feel special. Obviously, she's going to go there. She doesn't have an adult perspective to realize what's going on and where it's leading up to. He, on the other hand, is very similar in a lot of ways. He's trapped in a life that is devoid of anything that makes him feel really valid or special. And his interactions with her take him back to a time when life was really exciting and the world was his oyster, so to speak. But he is an adult. He knows better.
Where do the themes overlap with her being of foreign extraction from the Middle East in the middle of America? Where does that overlap with the story of child sexual abuse?
Well, I think they're both instances of objectification. In a lot of ways, we're all towelhead of some sort or another to somebody else because of who we are.
Now, the title has gotten some criticism from the Council on American Islam Relations CARE.
Right.
They've come out and said, please change the title. We think it's insulting. We don't like it. I know it's the title of the book you based the movie on. Did you think, maybe I should change it, or no, I'm not going to?
I did change the title at the beginning because the movie was independently financed, and I thought nobody's going to buy a movie called Towelhead, even though I think that's the title that the author chose. She herself is Arab-American. And then when Warner Independent bought the movie, they said, you have to change the title of the movie that you have right now, which was Nothing is Private, which is a really horrible title. We spent days combing lists of possible titles, and eventually I just thought, you know, the title of the book is Towelhead, and the best title for this story is Towelhead. It is offensive. It's hate language. That's the point.
Long time no see, Towelhead.
Don't call me that.
Okay. Camel jockey.
Shut up.
Okay. Sand. Ow! You're in big trouble, Towelhead!
You're openly gay. What if there were a movie out made by someone else called The F Word?
Faggot.
Well, there you go. You said it.
Even if I didn't like it, I would support that person's right to call that movie that. I don't think it's the word itself. It's the context in which it's used. And ultimately, we have to disempower these words anyway.
This theme that you're talking about in Towelhead of disenfranchised groups mm-hmm. of people and marginalization, this provides me with a great segue to talk about your TV mm-hmm. series, True Blood, which mm-hmm. is about vampires. Talk about outsiders, mm-hmm. the undead. Did you purposefully have this theme in mind when you thought about this series?
I don't think that way. I don't think in a sort of cerebral academic way when I work. It's much more organic. When I read Charlene Harris's novels on which the series is based, I thought that was so entertaining and clever, and yet at the same time it didn't feel didactic or preachy because it was vampires. You can't really take it that seriously.
Yeah, I mean, it's really tongue-in-cheek. You have vampires going on TV, you know, asking for their rights.
Number one, show me documentation. Doesn't exist. Number two, doesn't your race have a history of exploitation? We never owned slaves, Bill, or detonated nuclear weapons. And most importantly, point number three, now that the Japanese have perfected synthetic blood, which satisfies all of our nutritional needs, there is no reason for anyone to fear us.
Yeah, it is tongue-in-cheek, absolutely. There's an anti-vampire church. They show up and they hold signs that say God hates fangs. And it is tongue-in-cheek, but it's fun. It's clever.
And it's full of sex.
It's very sexy.
Vampires have always been a metaphor for sex, right?
Absolutely. I have discovered since reading Charlene's books that there is a whole market for vampire romantic fiction. And I'll admit it, there's a lot of sex and violence in this show.
And obviously theme of death, which yep. is 6 feet under,
yep.
taking place in a funeral home.
Yes, sex and death.
Sex and death, two great themes in the American novel and elsewhere.
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, well, Alan Ball, thank you very much.
My pleasure, thank you.
Alan Ball is the creator of True Blood. It's a series on HBO which debuts this Sunday. He's also the director of the new film Towelhead. It opens next week. Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Alex Chadwick.
One of the most anticipated video games ever is finally coming out this weekend. It's called Spore. There's so much excitement because it was created by Will Wright, the man who designed the popular SimCity and The Sims. His latest creation takes its inspiration from evolutionary biology, and for the most part, scientists are giving it a thumbs up. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
It took 7 years for Will Wright to finish Spore.
Why did it take so long?
It's kind of a hard game to make.
The game is about nothing less than 1 billion years of evolutionary history.
So basically, you start as this microscopic cell. Eventually, you kind of leave water. You continue to evolve for many generations.
You start the game in primitive waters, eating algae and trying not to get eaten. When you've grown enough, you can find a mate.
Then we mate, and what we're going to do now is lay an egg for the next generation of our species. And this is how I get back into the editor. And so I'm basically designing the next evolution of my species.
The editor is where you can add features to your creature. A new mouth, a nicer nose, faster fins, in later stages, faster legs, a bigger brain. You buy them with points you get from eating.
If you step way back, you know, evolution is about incremental improvement of a species embedded in a larger ecosystem over large periods of time. And that was kind of like the general presentation, the toy that we wanted to build of evolution.
To create Spore, Wright consulted with biologists and other scientists to get a greater understanding of the process of evolution.
Once you see this, you'll never think about abalone the same way.
Okay.
In this scene from a National Geographic documentary about Spore, Will Wright is consulting with marine biologist Tierney Teiss.
Okay. Is this its mouth?
This is its mouth.
Ooh, that's cool. Looks like some kind of mechanical
buzz
grinder.
Yeah, and that's what we call radula.
I was sat with Will and had the pleasure of introducing him to a lot of really crazy animals out there that don't get a lot of silver screen time, things like a radula. It's a buzzsaw-like mouth apparatus of mollusks.
T says the game isn't really a true mirror of nature, but she does believe it may help young people get interested in science.
I think there's so much potential for perhaps incorporating it into animal diversity classes. Or going tide pooling and then seeing mixing and matching, using the natural world as your inspiration for your virtual world.
Will Wright has built a career on games drawn with great detail. From there, he creates entire worlds that mimic the real one, says Chris Swain, a professor at the School of Cinematic Arts at USC. The Sims, which recreated the life of a real family, relied on behavioral science. Swain says follow-up game SimCity lets players take up real issues of urban planning.
And you get these 10-year-olds that can make these very sophisticated statements about what they need to do to their city to make it prosper, lower the tax base, and we'll raise the revenue here. And they say things that a mayor would say.
Spore gets even bigger. Your creature evolves into a species that develops a civilization that can be warlike or, as Wright explains, religious.
And we're going to go over to our neighbors here and try to convert them. Now, it's going to be a little hard because they're fairly happy, which is their best defense against religious conversion.
Depending on how your creature has evolved, whether it's been through dominance or cooperation, will determine what kind of cities you build during the civilization phase. Eventually, your civilization can conquer space. Spore goes on sale in the U.S. this Sunday, but already people are taking advantage of a preview where they can create creatures and share them online. There are more than 3 million to be found, waiting for their chance to evolve, mate, and eventually conquer the universe. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com and Broadcasting and Cable Magazine. Ever since The Sopranos cut to black, HBO has been searching for the next big thing. The show that replaced it, John from Cincinnati, sure wasn't it. Not only was that David Milch series a big disappointment, but its appearance meant the disappearance of Milch's Deadwood, the HBO series that at the time was the best drama on television. Showtime, meanwhile, captured lots of attention and deserved every drop of it with Dexter, its creepy, funny, bloody drama about a serial killer who kills other serial killers. So it makes sense that HBO, which was in need of a creative transfusion anyway, went with its own creepy, funny, bloody drama series and went back to one of its successful producers, Alan Ball, who had spent years on 6 Feet Under, surrounded by death and the dead. Now, in True Blood, which premieres Sunday, he's surrounded by death and the undead. Adapted from a series of novels by Charlaine Harris, True Blood is set in a small Louisiana town, small enough to be near both bayous and rundown plantation mansions. It's based on the premise that vampires, 2 years earlier, finally admitted they were real, not myth, and started to mainstream into regular society. They came out of the coffin, as one character describes it, because of the invention of a synthetic blood that could sustain vampires so they no longer had to drink human or animal blood. They can even go into bars and diners and order some, which is just what one vampire does in the opening episode of True Blood. His name is Bill, he's played by Stephen Moyer, and he's served by Sookie, a charming young waitress played by Anna Paquin. Sookie has her own secrets and hidden strengths. She's telepathic, for one thing. But Sookie can't hear Bill's thoughts at all. So when he enters Sam's diner, she knows he's different. And she's not scared. She's fascinated. And as excited as a preteen girl meeting a Jonas brother.
Hi, what can I get for you tonight?
Do you have any of that synthetic bottled blood?
No, I'm so sorry. Sam got some a year ago, but nobody ever ordered it, so it went bad. You're our first vampire.
Am I that obvious?
I knew the minute you came in. Can't believe nobody else around here seems to.
He does.
Oh, don't worry about Sam. He's cool. I know for a fact he supports the Vampire Rights Amendment.
How progressive of him.
Well, anything else you drink?
Actually, no. But you can get me a glass of red wine so I have a reason to be here.
Well, whatever the reason, I'm glad you are.
If you were a fan of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and I hope you were, You're already comfortable with the idea of mixing terror and humor in a vampire story. Buffy was better, and actually a lot more subtle, but True Blood approaches things differently. Buffy, like a David Lynch drama, was about finding darkness hidden in the sunniest of places. It was set, after all, in Sunnydale. And more than anything else, Buffy was about the epic, endless struggle between good and evil. True Blood has other things on its mind. It's big on allegory, and the tension about accepting vampires into society is an obvious play on civil rights in general and gay rights in particular. Sometimes too obvious, but it's interesting anyway. Even better is the idea that just as vampires can feed on humans, certain humans in True Blood like to feed on vampires. They either seek them out as exciting, dangerous sexual partners, or synthesize vampire blood as a potent new black market drug. So while some outlaw vampires continue to hunt humans, there are some outlaw humans hunting vampires, while others, like Sookie and Bill, just want to get along. But what chance do you have to love one another till death do you part when loving a vampire means it's death at the start? True Blood explores that question, and others, in a show that builds, slowly but surely. Stay with it for a few episodes, and you'll be craving your weekly dose of True Blood. It's not going to replace The Sopranos, but as a synthetic substitute, it'll do for now.
We've been spending part of this year remembering one of the most tumultuous years in our history, 1968, 40 years ago. It was the year of the murders of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. It was a year of riots and anti-war protests. There were also cultural upheavals, which were visible on the silver screen. And that's our subject in the latest report in our series, Echoes of 1968. Here's NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg.
The 1968 Academy Awards ceremony was postponed for 2 days because of Martin Luther King's assassination. When the time came to name the Oscar winner for Best Picture, the list included films with lines that have lasted low these many years.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
The Graduate, directed by Mike Nichols, a film that defined generation gap.
This year's Miss Bonnie Parker.
Glad to meet you.
I'm Clyde Barrow.
Clyde.
We robbed banks.
Bonnie and Clyde, directed by Arthur Penn, a folktale of Depression-era robbery and bloodshed.
And it never occurred to me that I might fall in love with a Negro. But I did, and nothing in the world is going to change that.
Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, directed by Stanley Kramer. Interracial marriage in a liberal and patrician white family.
Virgil, that's a funny name for a nigger boy that comes from Philadelphia. What do they call you up there?
They call me Mr. Tibbs.
In the Heat of the Night, directed by Norman Jewison, about racial tensions and murder in a small Mississippi town. Oh, yes, and this one.
It's incredible. It's impossible. But it's true. A man can talk to the animals.
Dr. Doolittle, directed by Richard Fleischer, about, you know. And the Oscar went to In the Heat of the Night, in many ways the tamest film of the bunch. Other Best Picture nominees were hotter, bolder. In a book about 60s movie making, Mark Harris says Hollywood then mostly meant World War II stories, westerns, and epics. So some of those new films were revolutionary.
I think the revolution was that movies finally started to catch up with what was going on in the culture at large.
Civil rights were much on people's minds in the late 60s, more so than the Vietnam War, at least in movie theaters. And Heat of the Night was about race as well as whodunit. But in his book, Pictures at a Revolution, Five Movies and the Birth of the New Hollywood, Mark Harris says the real competition that 1968 Oscar night was for the future of movie making.
I think there was a general sense that Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate were going to be more lasting achievements than In the Heat of the Night, which was, I think, seen as a very skillful, traditional Hollywood mystery with a good liberal message in it.
Bonnie and Clyde was revolutionary, influenced by a new wave of gritty, realistic foreign films. Audiences fell in love with the gorgeous protagonists, Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway playing Robin Hoods, whose Robin ways, and in a shockingly prolonged volley of bullets. Their first holdup is a farce.
They go into the bank. They say,
stick up.
Nobody hears them. So they have to say it louder and get everybody's attention.
It serves a stick up.
Meanwhile, their inept getaway driver is trying to parallel park the getaway car. But when they come out of the bank with all the money to make their getaway, they don't know where he's parked.
Hi, where's the car?
When they finally get into the car, you're laughing. Then the bank manager jumps onto the rear windshield.
Clyde turns around and shoots him, and you see the bullet go through the windshield and the lens of his eyeglasses, and his face explodes in blood.
Bang, the laughter stops. The movie goes ugly and disoriented. Bang, a new kind of filmmaking. Mark Harris says The Graduate, another Best Picture nominee at the 1968 Oscar ceremonies, was revolutionary in several ways.
The Graduate, perhaps more than any of the five movies, really did change things because, if nothing else, it was the biggest hit of the five. In fact, by the end of its run, which was, I think, two full years in theaters, it was the third highest grossing movie in history.
Upper middle class L.A., disaffected college grad seduced by older woman falls in love with her daughter. Sure. But here's the revolution. The story is told from a new point of view.
Suddenly, the kind of camera had shifted, and this was looking at the generation gap now from the other side of the generation gap, from the young side.
And there's more. Young people raced to see The Graduate. Hollywood discovered a new audience.
And that was who movies started to get made for after that.
Have you thought about graduate school?
No.
Would you mind telling me then what those 4 years of college were for? What was the point of all that hard work?
You got me.
Have you given any thought to the problems your children are going to have?
Yes, and they'll have some.
Sidney Poitier and Spencer Tracy in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
Is that the way Joey feels?
She feels that every single one of our children will be president of the United States, and they'll all have colorful administrations.
Guess Who's Coming to Dinner almost didn't get made. Here's how the director's widow tells the story. Karen Kramer says Hollywood wasn't ready for a film about interracial marriage. The topic, in certain places in America then, was taboo and illegal, and Stanley Kramer knew it.
He was afraid to tell Columbia Pictures what the subject matter was completely about because, look, as an investment for Columbia Pictures, it can't play in 16 states in this country or it would cause riots. It's not a good investment for a studio. So he would tap dance his way out of giving them a screenplay. And he said, look, I've got Spencer Tracy, I've got Katharine Hepburn, I've got Sidney Poitier, and it's a love story. Well, is it not a love story? It is a love story. But he didn't want to give them the script because he knew that they would have objections to it.
Eventually, according to Karen Kramer, her husband had no choice. He handed over the script. The film was canceled. Columbia claimed they were worried about Spencer Tracy's health. He'd been ill for many years. Stanley Kramer felt that was a cover. He had an idea. The director and his wife went to see Katharine Hepburn.
And he said, Kate, look it. I'm going to put up my salary as collateral for this film. And will you do the same? And she said, are you serious? He said, yes. And she said, I will too.
The film got made. Months before Guess Who's Coming to Dinner was released, the Supreme Court said laws forbidding miscegenation were unconstitutional. And Karen Kramer says real life helped the film in another way.
Dean Rusk, who was Secretary of State in 1968's daughter, married another Stanford student who just happened to be black. It made the front page in every newspaper in this country.
In the summer of 1968, the Beatles sang about revolution. But even before that, a revolution in movie making was playing on the silver screens of America. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
You can find scenes from those Best Picture nominees at npr.org.